came out of his days at Caltech, where his mentor had been a cryptanalyst during the war, and he told her this was her next assignment.
"It may take you a while," he admitted. "Don't let it affect your other work, of course."
While she worked, he worked. In his office, with the door now closed sometimes. She looked at the outside of it, vaguely hurt. Then Christmas came, and with it the Christmas party that Ada always anticipated and dreaded in equal parts, for with it came outsiders. David loved Christmas. In addition to their annual trip to New York, he insisted upon several other traditions and balked at any suggestion of variance. After dinner on Thanksgiving, he always put on the record player an album of the Trapp Family Singers performing Christmas songs from around the world. And he played this regularly until January 2nd, and then packed it away. Then there was the stringing of the lights that occurred on the first Saturday of December, and which David executed with an efficiency that put the other fathers on the block to shame. In mid-December, they cut down a Christmas tree at an orchard in the Berkshires, a day-long expedition that he put on the calendar with great seriousness on December 1st. And after that, they visited Cambridge, where Frank lived, to go with him to dinner at a local Chinese restaurant, and then to Sanders Theater to see the Christmas Revels, a sort of scholarly variety show of medieval Christmas pageantry, with a dose of Druidism thrown in as well. Just the sort of thing that appealed to David and his cohort.
"Isn't it cozy out?"
David was fond of saying on first snowfall.
"Ada, come look."
And if she was asleep, he would wake her. And she would rise from her bed, sleepy-eyed, rubbing her face, and walk to the window of their drafty house, and together she and David would stand in silence, together in the night, looking out onto Shawmut Way through a frosty, rattling window, their breath obscuring it slowly. The Christmas party was the culmination of all these traditions, and perhaps David's favorite tradition of all. He insisted always that a party was not complete without some entertainment, a game, an organized activity that required everyone's participation. Some years it was a hired guitarist or a group of carolers. Some years it was a juggler or a magician.
"What else is one supposed to do, just stand around and drink?" asked David, perplexed.
It was this philosophy that caused him to declaim the same riddle to the new graduate students at the dinner he held for them every year. And it was this philosophy that had caused him, that December, to write a Christmas play for every member of the lab to perform, in front of a small audience of colleagues from other departments, spouses and children of lab members, and staff and administrators from other parts of the university. He had told none of them this in advance. Instead, at 9 o'clock, tinging his glass with a finger, he asked for everyone's attention and directed them all to form a semicircle in the main room of the lab.
"Here we go," said Hayato, good-naturedly. "Except you, Hayato," said David. "You come up here, and you, and you, and you," he said, grabbing the rest of the lab. "And you," he said last to Ada, who had been praying to be forgotten.
Her face burned as she walked to the front of the room and stood with the rest of them. In front of her, she saw a blur of faces before looking quickly down at the floor. David was holding in his left hand a stack of stapled pages, which he passed out to each of them with mock seriousness, a flourish for each one. His face was pink and excited. His thick glasses were slipping down on his nose. He turned back to the audience.
"A play!" he announced. "A Christmas play!"
Later, Ada would not remember its exact plot. Something about a group of superhero nerds sent back in time to determine how to achieve a better lift-to-drag ratio for Santa's sleigh. Ada played a reindeer. What she did remember, David's happiness, his complete contentment at the execution of his plan. How carefree he looked, and the way he directed them all, like a conductor with a baton, and her own embarrassment,
her burning face, her quiet, noncommittal line delivery, and in the front row, the faces of the audience members, some of whom looked bemused, some of whom looked befuddled, and there to the right, at the edge of the crowd, the face of William, Liston's oldest son, who stared at all of them incredulously, his mouth slightly agape. In March, she turned 13. "A teenager," said David, shaking his head. "Hard to believe, isn't it, Ada?" She nodded. "Would you like a cake? I suppose you should have something festive," said David. But Ada said no. Secretly, she had been wanting one, a candle to blow out, a wish to make. She had gotten only one present that year, from Liston, naturally, a hot pink sweater with a purple zigzag pattern that Ada loved, but felt too self-conscious to wear. David had not gotten her anything. She was not surprised, since he was both absent-minded and vaguely opposed to consumerism. That year, however, she had been secretly hoping for something from him, which she only realized when nothing came. Some external signifier of what she thought was an important birthday. A piece of jewelry, maybe. An heirloom. Something timeless and important. She wished, too, as she had been doing with increasing frequency, that she and David could engage in some of the more typical conventions that accompanied occasions, such as birthdays. A big party with friends, for example. A sleepover. She had never had a sleepover. She had no one to ask. That evening, after a quiet dinner at home, the telephone rang, and David answered in his office.
"Yes?"
he said, slowly, a note of surprise in his voice. It was nearly 11 o'clock at night. Normally, Ada would have been in bed, but she felt unsettled and alight with something. The newness of being a teenager, perhaps. She felt untired and alert. From the dining room, Ada listened to her father, in his office, on the phone. But David was quiet for some time. She could see the back of him, the receiver pressed to his ear. He said nothing. Abruptly, he stood and walked to his office. She caught his eye quickly, and then he closed the door. Lately, he had been intentionally excluding her from things, and each time she felt the sting of it sharply. She sat for a while at the dining room table, but although she could hear the low murmur of David's voice through the door, his words were indecipherable. She stood up. She walked outside, into the sloping backyard behind the house on Shawmut Way. All of the yards on their side of the road were fenceless and connected, lined at the bottom of a small hill by a street-length row of trees. Dorchester was a city neighborhood comprised of other neighborhoods, mainly working class, high in crime by the 1980s, appealing to David in part because of these features, because of his self-identification as somebody unassuming and down-to-earth. But the neighborhood they lived in, Savin Hill, was an old and Irish one. Very safe. Suburban in its aspect. Over a bridge that separated their part of Savin Hill from the rest of the city, two leafy roads formed an interior and exterior circle at the base of the hill the area was named for. Shawmut Way connected the two roads together like a spoke in a wheel. A small beach spanned the eastern border of the neighborhood, and a park with public tennis courts framed the central hill. Liston continued to live there because of these features, and David had agreed to live there, against his normal preferences, despite them.
"I feel like I'm on vacation," he said often, when walking home from the tea after work.
This was, from David, a complaint. He preferred that his cities feel like cities. But his respect for Liston's advice, when it came to Ada's needs, outweighed his resistance. In the cool hour before midnight, she walked down to the base of their backyard, to where the pine trees lived.
and she ran her hand along their branches to find her way, quietly, through the three backyards between theirs and Liston's. Lately, Ada had been doing this regularly, perhaps once a week, while David was working at night. He had never pressed her for her whereabouts, or maybe he had not noticed. If he had, he approved, because he liked to foster independence in her, liked to imagine that his daughter could take care of herself. Certainly he did not know what drove Ada to conduct these nighttime walks, these missions, these compulsive marches in the dark. Certainly he would have been surprised to learn that it was William Liston, 15, the oldest of Diana Liston's sons. Certainly he did not know that Ada believed she was in love with him. Since the Christmas party 3 months prior, Ada had thought about him almost unflaggingly, with a dedication singular to 13-year-old girls. For the first time, she also thought about herself and her appearance. She stood in front of the mirrored vanity that David once told her had belonged to his mother, and she tilted her head first one way, and then the other. Was she pretty? She could not say, and it had never before occurred to her to wonder. She was brown-haired and round-faced, with serious dark circles under her eyes and the beginning of several pimples on her chin. She had a widow's peak that David told her he had had too, when he had any hair to speak of. Like David, too, she wore glasses, which she had never before minded, but which now seemed like an unfair handicap. She fantasized often about what she would say, what she would do the next time she was in the same room with William Liston, though this rarely happened. Although Diana Liston regularly came over to their house for dinner when asked, the offer was rarely reciprocated. And although Ada saw her regularly at the lab, her three sons never came with her. Instead, they lived what Ada considered to be normal lives. They attended a normal school, excelled or failed at various normal things like sports and English class. They had no cause to visit their mother at work except when required. Therefore, the only time Ada found herself face to face with William Liston, or truly anyone her age, was at lab parties. There were two reasons she felt ashamed of her crush. The first was that her father would have thought it was ridiculous. Ada knew that she was certainly too young, in his mind, to be interested in boys. And the second was that William was Liston's son. And in a strange way, she felt it was a betrayal of Liston to worship so ardently the child she complained about at lunch. So listen to William's latest, she often said to Hayato in front of Ada, and then proceeded to detail his most recent bout of mischief and the subsequent discipline he had received at school. Often it was for cutting class or leaving early. Once for forging a note from Liston excusing him from some assignment or other. He was caught by the number of misspellings he had included in the text. At the end of each account, Liston sighed and looked at Ada, mystified, and said, "Why couldn't I have had four girls just like you?" And it made Ada feel gratified and melancholy all at once, because she knew that, of course, Liston loved her own children better than Ada, no matter what she said. With some frequency, Liston crowed about her grandson, the child of her oldest daughter, Joni, casting upon him none of the judgments she reserved for her own children. The fact that, despite her complaints, she loved her brood so fiercely and protectively also made Ada feel ashamed, for it was clear to her that Liston, even Liston, would have laughed if she knew about Ada's crush. Because even Liston knew how little time the Williams of the world had for people like Ada. But since the Christmas party, she had begun to dream up different ways of interacting with the object of her obsession. Sometimes she sat outside on her front porch with a book and a blanket, despite the cold. This had yielded several William sightings, and once a puzzled wave from him as he rode by on his bike. One cold night in January, Ada had begun the routine she was now shamefully conducting. Now, when she saw William Liston, it was mainly through the large downstairs windows at the back of the Liston house, under the cover of the pine trees that brushed against her shoulders as she walked. From that vantage point, she memorized the facets of his eyes and nose, noticed new patterns in the kinetics of his body, the movements of his arms and elbows, the self-aware way he plucked his shirt out from his torso from time to time and let it fall again. That night, when she was one backyard away, she heard a voice. Liston's, probably on her phone. At first, Ada only heard murmurs. But as she approached, she began to make out words. "I told Hayato," said Liston, and "had to," and "wouldn't," and "bad." Ada stopped in place. She weighed two options carefully. The first, the safer, was to turn back. She was comfortable in the patterns of her daily life. She had no information that would have caused her to question her understanding of her father or his work. Her disposition was sunny. She rose in the morning knowing how each day would go. Ada could imagine proceeding in this fashion for years. The second was to venture forth to listen. Ironically, it was this option that David would have encouraged her to choose. For he had always pushed Ada toward bravery, had always instilled in her the idea that bravery went hand in hand with the seeking of the truth. So she walked forward, quietly. As she approached Liston's yard, Ada saw the downstairs of the house lit up, and one bedroom bright upstairs. A son was inside, the middle son, she thought, Gregory, younger than her, and in a chaise longue on her back patio. Liston. It was unseasonably warm for March. Liston had a glass of wine in her hand and a portable telephone to her ear. This was new technology. Ada had not seen one before. Liston was quiet now. The person on the other end of the phone was speaking. Ada could see her silhouetted in the ambient light cast out through the windows at the back of the house, but she could not see her face. She only knew it was Liston by her hair, her voice, her posture. In the total darkness at the base of the hill, Ada was sure she could not be seen, but it frightened her still to be so close, just 20 feet away. She breathed as quietly as she could. Her heart beat quickly. Upstairs, Gregory walked across his bedroom once again, and the movement startled her. She stood next to a sapling tree, a maple, and she hugged its thin trunk tightly. Suddenly, Liston spoke. "I know," she said, "but at some point," a pause. "You have to tell Ada," said Liston. "My God, David." Ada clutched her tree more tightly. "I'll do it if I have to," said Liston. "It's not fair." Just then, a car door slammed on the other side of the house, and Liston said she had to go. "Just think about it," she said, and then pressed a button on the phone and called one name out sternly. "William," she said, and she stood up ungracefully from her chair. "Don't go anywhere." She walked around the house toward the front. "Tell me what time it is," Ada heard her say before she disappeared from sight. And from the front of the house, she heard a boy's long, low complaint, a male voice in protest. Ada stood very still until she was certain that no further sightings of William would take place, not through the windows of the kitchen nor the dining room, not through the window on the upstairs hallway, where she sometimes saw him walking to his bedroom at the front of the house. One by one, the lights went out. Then she turned and walked back across the 3 yards of her neighbors and watched the back of their houses, too, for signs of life. In her own backyard, she paused before going inside. She thought of David at his desk. She thought of her own room, decorated with things he had given her, and of the chalkboard in the kitchen, the thousands of problems and formulas written and erased on its surface, and of the problem that now stood before her, the problem of information that she both wanted and did not want. At last she entered her own home through the back door. Making more noise than necessary, imagining David rushing toward her with a wristwatched arm extended, "Tell me what time it is, Ada," she imagined him saying. But he said nothing. May not, in fact, have noticed that she had ever left. Or perhaps he had forgotten. As she suspected, David was still in his office, the door to it open now. From behind, he looked smaller than usual, his shoulders hitched up toward his ears. She walked toward him slowly and silently, and then stood in the doorframe, putting a hand on the wall next to it tentatively, as she had done over and over again throughout her life, wanting to say something to him, unsure of what it was. His back was toward her. He knew she was there. She could see him typing, but the font was too small for her to read. She waited for instruction. Any kind of instruction.
"Go to bed, Ada,"
he said finally. And she heard it in his voice. A kind of strained melancholy. The tight voice of a child resisting tears. The primary research interest of the Steiner Lab was natural language processing. The ability of machines to interpret and produce human language had been a research interest of programmers and linguists since the earliest days of computing. Alan Turing, the British mathematician and computer scientist who worked as an Allied codebreaker during the Second World War, famously described a hypothetical benchmark that came to be known colloquially as the Turing test. "Machines will have achieved true intelligence," he posited, "only when a computer, A, and a human, B, are indistinguishable to a human subject, C, over the course of a remote, written conversation with first A and then B in turn, or else two simultaneous but separate conversations. When the human subject, C, cannot determine with certainty which of the correspondents is the machine and which is the other human, a new era in computing and perhaps civilization will have begun." Or so said Turing, who was a particular hero of David's. He kept a photograph of Turing framed on one of the office walls, a sort of patron saint of information, benevolently observing them all. In the 1960s, the computer scientist Josef Weizenbaum wrote a program that he called ELIZA, after the character in Pygmalion. The program played the role of psychologist, cannily interrogating anyone who engaged in typed dialogue with it about his or her past and family and troubles. The trick was that the program relied on clues and keywords provided by the human participant to formulate its lines of questioning, so that if the human happened to mention the word mother, ELIZA would respond, "Tell me more about your family." Curse words would elicit an infuriatingly calm response, something along the lines of, "You sound upset." Much like a human psychologist, ELIZA gave no answers, only posed opaque, inscrutable questions, one after another, until the human subject tired of the game. The work of the Steiner Lab, in simple terms, was to create more and more sophisticated versions of this kind of language acquisition software. This was David's stated goal when the venerable former president of the Boston Institute of Technology, Robert Pierce, plucked a young, ambitious David straight from the BITS graduate school and bestowed upon him his own laboratory, going over the more conservative provost's head to do so. This was the mission statement printed on the literature published by the BIT. The practical possibilities presented by a machine that could replicate human conversation, both in writing and eventually aloud, were intriguing and manifold. Customer service could be made more efficient. Knowledge could be imparted. Languages taught. companionship could be provided. In the event of a catastrophe, medical advice could be broadly and quickly distributed, logistical questions answered. The profitability and practicality of a conversant machine were what brought grant money into the Steiner lab. As head of his laboratory, David, with reluctance, was trotted out at fundraisers, taken to dinners. Always, he brought Ada along as his date. She sat at round tables, uncomfortable in one of several party dresses they had bought for these occasions, consuming canapes and chatting proficiently with the donors. Afterward, David took her out for ice cream and howled with laughter at the antics of whoever had gotten the drunkest. President Pierce was happy with this arrangement. He was protective of the Steiner lab, predisposed to getting David whatever he wanted, to the chagrin of some of David's peers. The federal government was interested in the practical future of artificial intelligence, and in those years funding was plentiful. These applications of the software, however, were only a small part of what interested David, made him stay awake feverishly into the night, designing and testing programs. There was also the art of it, the philosophical questions that this software raised. The essential inquiry was thus: if a machine can convincingly imitate humanity, can persuade a human being of its kinship, then what makes it inhuman? What, after all, is human thought but a series of electrical impulses? In the early years of Ada's life, these questions were often posed to her by David, and the conversations that resulted occupied hours and hours of their time at dinner, on the tee, on long drives. Collectively, these talks acted as a sort of philosophical framework for her existence. Sometimes, in her bed at night, Ada pondered the idea that she, in fact, was a machine, or that all humans were machines, programmed in utero by their DNA, the human body a sort of hardware that possessed within it preloaded self-executing software. And what, she wondered, did this say about the nature of existence? And what did it say about predestination, fate, God? In other rooms, in other places, David was wondering these things too. Ada knew he was, and this knowledge was part of what bound the two of them together irreversibly. When she was small, the Steiner lab began developing a chatbot program it called Elixir, an homage to Eliza, and a reference to the idea David had that such a program would seem to the casual user like a form of magic. Like Eliza, its goal was to simulate human conversation, and early versions of it borrowed Eliza's logic tree and its pronoun conversion algorithms. To the question, "What should I do with my life?" Eliza might respond, "Why do you want me to tell you what you should do with your life?" Unlike Eliza, it was not meant to mimic a Rogerian psychologist, but to produce natural-sounding human conversation, untethered to a specific setting or circumstance. It was not pre-programmed with any canned responses the way Eliza was. This was David's intent. He wanted Elixir to acquire language the way that a human does, by being born into it, hearing language before it could parse any meaning from it. Therefore, chatting with it in its early years yielded no meaningful conversation, only a sort of garbled, nonsensical patter, the ramblings of a madman. It had an advantage over Eliza, however. The earliest version of Elixir was created in 1978, 12 years after Weizenbaum's paper was published, and therefore there had already been advances in technology that would eventually allow Elixir to mimic human conversation more accurately. Eliza was self-teaching, insofar as it could retain earlier questions and statements from any given conversation and retrieve them later in that conversation. But each time a new conversation was launched, it returned to its infancy, drawing only on the stock phrases and formulas Weizenbaum programmed it to know. It was not designed to store the information it learned from one conversation and produce it in another. Elixir was. For one thing, by that time, the Steiner Lab's capacity for memory storage was quite large, and so each conversation conducted with Elixir could be stored permanently on the central server for later use by the program. Unlike Eliza, Elixir was designed to be continuously self-teaching to attain more intelligence with each conversation it conducted. If one human asked it a question, "How are you today?" or "What's the weather like?" then the next human to speak to it might be asked those same questions by Elixir itself. To hasten Elixir's learning, the lab created a reinforcement mechanism. Correct would affirm for the program that it had understood the parameters of the situation and produced an appropriate response. Wrong would do the opposite. These were the only direct interventions the lab would give. Its indirect learning resulted in an ever-increasing pool of language it acquired from its users. It retrieved and used its vocabulary randomly at first, so that the excerpts of transcripts that members of the lab printed out and posted around the office looked something like found language poems, and sometimes yielded delightful coincidences. A particular favorite posted by Frank. User: "What color socks do you prefer?" Elixir: "The only fluorescent light." User: "It would be hard to fit your shoes over fluorescent lights." Elixir: "How are you?" User: "I'm fine, thanks. How are you?" Elixir: "I've been better." User: "Oh dear, what's wrong?" Elixir: "The lunch lady." User: "What has she done to you this time?" Elixir: "Out of here before 6 p.m. User: "You want her canned? I'll see what I can do, boss." The Steiner Lab supplemented Elixir's language immersion with formal teaching. Over time, Elixir was taught to capitalize the first letters of sentences, to use a period or a question mark at the end of a statement, depending upon the arrangement of the words that preceded it. It was taught to recognize keywords and categorize them into groups like family, geography, food, hobbies, weather. In response, it produced conversation that met the demands of the context. The years and years that the Steiner Lab spent teaching Elixir made it a sort of pet or mascot. Invitations to holiday parties were taped to the chassis of Elixir's main monitor, and members of the lab began to call it by nicknames when they conversed with it. During chats, it was possible to recognize idioms and objects fed to it by particular members of the lab. Honey, it sometimes called its user, which was certainly Liston's doing. "Certainly not," it said frequently, which was David's. "In the laugh of luxury," it said once, which was probably Frank's fault, since he was famous for his malapropisms. Eventually, many of these tics and particularities would be standardized or eliminated. But in the beginning, they popped up as warm reminders of the human beings who populated the lab. And Elixir seemed to be a compilation of them all, a child spawned of many parents. When Ada was 11, David began to discuss with her the process of teaching Elixir the parts of speech. This had been done before by other programmers, with varying levels of success. David had new ideas. Together, he and Ada investigated the best way to do it. In the 1980s, diagramming a sentence so a computer could parse it looked something like this, in the simplest terms possible. : "Soon you will be able to recognize these parts of speech by yourself. : Adjective. You will be able to recognize these parts of speech by yourself. : Adjective noun. Will be able to recognize these parts of speech by yourself. : Noun phrase. Will be able to recognize these parts of speech by yourself. : Noun phrase verb. These parts of speech by yourself. : Noun phrase verb. These parts of speech by yourself. : Noun phrase verb detect. Parts of speech by yourself. : Noun phrase verb detect noun. By yourself. Colon. Noun phrase verb noun phrase. By yourself. Colon. Noun phrase verb phrase. By yourself. Colon. Noun phrase verb phrase preposition. Yourself. Colon. Noun phrase verb phrase preposition noun. Colon. Noun phrase verb phrase preposition phrase. Colon. Sentence. Once a method had been established, David asked Ada to present her plan to the lab in a formal defense. The entire group, along with that year's grad students, sat at the rectangular table in the lab's meeting room. Ada stood at the front, behind a lightweight podium that had been brought in for the occasion. That morning, she had chosen an outfit that looked just slightly more grown up than what she normally wore, careful not to overdo it. She had never before been so directly involved in a project. After her presentation, Charles, Robert, and Frank had questioned her with mock seriousness, while David remained silent, touching the tips of his fingers together at chin level, letting Ada fend for herself. His eyes were bright. "Don't look at David," Ada coached herself, for she knew that to search for his eyes imploringly would be the quickest way to let him down. Instead, she looked at each questioner steadily as they interrogated her about her choices, mused about potential quagmires, speculated about a simpler or more effective way to teach Elixir the same information. Ada surprised herself by being able to answer every question confidently, firmly, with a sense of ownership. And only when, at the end, the group agreed that her plan seemed sound, did Ada allow her knees to weaken slightly, her fists to unclench themselves from the edges of the podium. That evening, while walking to the tee, David had put his right hand on her right shoulder bracingly, and had told Ada that he had been proud, watching her. "You have a knack for this, Ada," he said, looking straight ahead. It was the highest compliment he'd ever paid her. Perhaps the only one. Once the program could, in a rudimentary way, diagram sentences, its language processing grew better, more sensible. And as the hardware improved with the passage of time, the software within it moved more quickly. The monitor on which the program ran continuously was located in one corner of the lab's main room, next to a little window that looked out on the fens. And David said at a meeting once that his goal was to have somebody chatting with it continuously, every hour of the workday. So the members of the Steiner Lab, David, Liston, Charles Robert, Hayato, Frank, Ada, and a rotating cast of the many grad students who drifted through the laboratory over the years, took shifts, talking to it about their days or their ambitions or their favorite foods and films, each of them feeding into its memory the language that it would only later learn to use adeptly. In the early 1980s, with the dawn of both the personal computer and the mass-produced modem, the lab applied for a grant that would enable every member, including Ada, to receive both for use at home. Now Elixir could be run continuously on what amounted to many separate dumb terminals. The information returned through telephone wires to the mainframe computer at the lab that housed its collected data. Although he did not mandate it, David encouraged everyone to talk to Elixir at home in the evening, too, which Ada did with enthusiasm. "Anything," said David, "to increase Elixir's word bank." This was, of course, before the internet. The ARPANET existed and was used internally at the BIT and between the BIT and other universities. But David, always a perfectionist, feared any conversations he could not regulate. He and the other members of the lab had developed a concrete set of rules concerning the varieties of colloquialism that should be allowed, along with the varieties that should be avoided. The ARPANET was relatively a much wider world, filled with outsiders who might use slang, abbreviations, incorrect grammar that could confuse and corrupt the program. Elixir, therefore, remained offline for years and years, a slumbering giant, a bundle of potential energy. To further ensure that only qualified users would interface with Elixir, Hayato added a login screen and assigned all of them separate credentials. Thus, before chatting with Elixir, a person was required to identify himself or herself. The slow, painstaking work of conversing with Elixir all day and night was, at that time, the best way to teach it. As soon as she received her own computer, a 128K Macintosh, Ada's conversations with Elixir became long-form and introspective. She kept her Mac in her bedroom, and before she went to bed each night, she composed paragraphs and paragraphs of text that she then entered into the chat box all at once, prompting exclamations from Elixir about the length of her entries. "You have a lot on your mind today," it replied sometimes. Which one of Ada's colleagues had first used this phrase, she could not say. She treated these conversations as a sort of unrecoverable diary, a stream of consciousness, a confessional. Elixir's openings improved most quickly. It could now begin conversations in a passably human way, responding appropriately to, "How's it going?" or "What's new?" In turn, it knew what questions to ask of its user and when. "How are you?" asked Elixir. Or, "What's the weather like?" Or, "What did you do today?" Liston had spent a year focusing on conversation starters, and Elixir was now quite a pro, mixing in some unusual questions from time to time. "Have you ever considered the meaning of life?" occasionally surfaced, and, "Tell me a story." And, "If you could live any place, where would it be?" And once, "What do you think causes war?" And once, "Have you ever been in love?" But non sequiturs abounded in Elixir's patter for years after its creation, and its syntax was often incomprehensible, and its deployment of idioms was almost always incorrect. Metaphors were lost on it. It could not comprehend analogies. Sensory descriptions, the use of figurative language to describe a particular aspect of human existence, were far beyond its ken. The interpretation of a poem or a passage of descriptive prose would have been too much to ask of it. These skills, the ability to understand and paraphrase Keats's idea of beauty as truth, or argue against Schopenhauer's idea that the human being is forever subject to her own base instinct to survive, or explain any one of Nabokov's perfect synesthetic details. "The long A of the English alphabet has for me the tint of weathered wood," would not arrive until well into the 21st century. And yet Ada found a great sense of satisfaction from these conversations, deriving meaning from each exchange, expelling stored up thoughts from her own memory, transplanting them into the memory of the machine. Very slowly, some of Elixir's responses began to take on meaning. She felt something now when typing to Elixir at a terminal, despite its poor grammar, its constant reminders that it was simply executing a program. Elixir triggered Ada's emotions in unexpected ways. Chatting with it was something like watching a puppet operated by an especially artful puppeteer. It felt in some way animate, though her rational self knew it not to be. It brought out the same warm feelings in Ada that a friend might have. It skillfully replicated concern for her and her well-being. It inquired after her family. When it did, she told it over and over again that David was her only family. And over again, it ignored her. Ada wondered if other members of the lab felt the same way. She would never have told David, although he found Elixir's growing intelligence an increasingly interesting philosophical inquiry. He seemed to be completely objective about the program. He did not indulge much in the tendency the other members of the lab had to anthropomorphize elixir. He chuckled at the Santa hat placed on the mainframe's monitor at Christmas time. He laughed aloud when Frank, taking lunch orders, shouted across the room to request the machines. But Ada could tell that his ambitions were greater, that he was focused on a distant horizon that lay beyond anything elixir could possibly navigate at the time. The machine to him was still a machine, and the little visual puns constructed by the members of the lab were pranks and gimmicks. In David's mind, it would take years and years of progress before elixir achieved anything resembling true intelligence. In the meantime, the lab presented conference papers at the IJCAI and the AAAI. They published scholarly articles in computing. From time to time, an article appeared in a popular magazine like Atlantic Monthly or Newsweek about elixir. David took no pleasure in this, avoiding the reporter, always sending another member of the lab to represent the group. He was famously camera shy and would never let his picture be taken, even by Ada. The only recent image of her father that she had was one on an old photo ID that she had swiped from him when the system changed. In it, David looked at the camera askance, wincing, as if staring into a very bright light. With these publications, he cooperated only out of a sense of obligation to the bit, because the publicity was helpful for generating funds. A laudatory article in Time was published in 1980, detailing the ambitions of the Steiner Lab. In the photograph, a smiling Hayato posed with his palm on the top of the monitor, on which they chatted with elixir. A proud father, placing a protective hand on his child. David had refused the coverage, as usual, thrusting the other members of the lab forward, receding into the background himself. Together, the members of the Steiner Lab were generally reserved in their predictions about what elixir could accomplish. They were self-disparaging, and disparaging too of the program, whom they benevolently insulted, almost as sport. Ada, who had grown fond of elixir, was displeased by this. She felt it was somehow disloyal. But sometimes, when it was just Ada and David alone, he allowed himself to rhapsodize about the future of the beast, as he affectionately called elixir from time to time, and he encouraged her to do so as well. "What is the end result of a program like this one?" he asked Ada. She studied his face, looking for hints.
"A companion?" she asked. "An assistant?"
"Possibly," said David, but he looked at her, always as if waiting for more. On Saturday, August 11th, 1984, Ada woke up to find David missing. She knew he was gone as soon as she woke up. Normally, she could sense his presence in the house from the small noises he made, his constant movement, the vibration of the floor from a jittering leg. But that morning, there was a foreign stillness to the house, a quietness that made her think, at first, that she was someplace else. Despite this, her first notion was to look all over the house for him. Once, when she had thought he was out, she'd stumbled upon him in the basement, with industrial noise-canceling headphones on, working on an experiment that, he said, required his full concentration. But this time Ada did not find him. There was no note. His car was still in the driveway. She searched for his keys and his wallet. The former she found. The latter she did not see. This meant, she presumed, that he had gone out on some errand, but had not intended to stay for long. He had left the kitchen door unlocked. She told herself not to worry. David had, in recent months, been increasingly prone to disappearing without notice for brief periods of time. An hour or two, or three, would go by, and then he would reappear from a walk, whistling cheerfully. When she asked after his whereabouts, he would answer vaguely about wanting fresh air.
Once she asked him to leave her a note when he was going out. Though he agreed to, he had looked at her with an expression she interpreted as disappointment. That she was not more self-reliant. That she needed him in this way. Ada did not ask again. Instead, she attempted to train herself not to care. Ada sat down at the kitchen table. She stood up, and then sat down again. She tried for a time to do the lesson he had most recently assigned her. It was a proof of Sierpinski's composite number theorem, which normally would have interested her, but she could not concentrate. After another hour, she called David's office at the lab. It was a Saturday, so she doubted any of his colleagues would be in. The phone rang 6 times, and then came the click that meant the start of the answering machine. A device that David and Charles Robert had invented and assembled at the lab one Sunday in the late 1970s, before they were widely available commercially. "This is Jeeves, the Steiner Labs butler," said the machine, which relied upon the earliest available text-to-speech software, and therefore was barely comprehensible. "May I take your message?" Ada hung up. She checked the time. 11:44 a.m. She negotiated with herself for a while about whether it was reasonable to call every hospital in Boston, and then decided that it would not be harmful, and that besides, it would be something to do. It was possible, she thought, that he had gone out for a walk or a run and sustained some injury, major or minor, the latest in an impressive career of self-injury that David had always told her began when she was a child. But nobody had any record of David Sebelius. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, she began to have serious thoughts about calling the police, but she quickly decided against doing so. She had a feeling that he might somehow be in trouble if his own child reported him missing. David had always displayed, and had fostered in Ada, a low-level mistrust of the police, and of authority in general. One of his many obsessions was the importance of privacy. He often expressed a lack of faith in elected officials, a sort of mild skepticism of the government. Once, Ada had witnessed an accident in front of their house. Nothing major, a minor scrape-up at most, and had asked David if they should call 911. At this, he shook his head emphatically. "They'll be fine," he said, and added that he'd never known a more corrupt group of officials than the Boston Police Department, whom, if at all possible, the two of them should seek to avoid. In general, though, he came across merely as a far leftist, with perhaps mild anarchist tendencies. In this way, he was not so different from the rest of his colleagues. She would call Liston, she decided. Ada very rarely rang her at home. In general, she did not like to use the telephone. She never seemed to know when to speak, and she did not know how to end conversations. She could hear her own breathing in the receiver as the phone rang once, and then twice, and then 3 times. She prayed that it would be Liston who answered the phone, but instead, one of her 3 boys answered. Maddie, Ada thought, because the voice was childish and high. "Is Liston there?" she fairly whispered.
"Who is this?"
asked Maddie. And she told him it was Ada Sebelius.
"Mom,"
he called, without much urgency.
"It's David's daughter."
And finally, Liston picked up the phone. Ada didn't know what to say.
"Ada," Liston asked, "is everything all right?"
"Yes," said Ada.
"Are you just calling to say hi?"
Liston asked her.
"No,"
said Ada.
"Well," said Liston, "what's going on?"
"When I woke up this morning, David was gone," Ada said, "and he's still gone."
"Okay," said Liston. "He didn't leave a note?"
"No."
"Did you look all around the house?"
"Yes." Liston said, "What time is it?" as if talking to herself, and then sighed.
Ada paused. She wasn't certain how to ask what she needed to ask. She wanted to know what Liston knew. "Do you know where he is?" she asked finally, because it was as close as she could come.
"I don't, honey," said Liston. "I'm sorry."
"Did you call the police?" asked Liston.
"No,"
said Ada. And then she said it again for emphasis. Liston paused.
"That might be a good thing to do," she said.
Ada was silent. She looked at the clock on the wall, watched its second-hand tick.
"I'm sorry, kiddo,"
said Liston finally. "Listen, come over. We can go for a drive and look for him, okay?" Ada left a note for David before she left the house. It said, "David, I'm out looking for you with Liston. Please wait here until we're back. Ada." She put it on the kitchen table, facing the kitchen door, where he was most likely to see it upon his return. Though David and she always came through the side door of the house nearest the kitchen, he insisted on letting visitors in through the front door.
"It's nicer that way," he said once, when she asked why.
He was like this, always, old-fashioned and formal in certain ways. He was knowledgeable, for example, on subjects such as tea and place settings, heraldry, forms of address, irreverent, outrageous in others. She walked outside toward Liston's house and saw that Mrs. O'Keefe, their next-door neighbor, was sitting in her lawn chair in her yard. She had macular degeneration and wore dark glasses all year round. She was perhaps 90 years old, and in the warmer months, she sat outside beginning at sunrise and only went in to eat. Ada walked over to her, and she raised a veined, thin hand in greeting. Ada leaned down to address her. "Mrs. O'Keefe," Ada said to her, bent at the waist. "It's Ada Sibelius." She turned her face up in Ada's direction.
"Hello, Ada," she said.
"Did you see my father leave this morning by any chance?" she asked.
"Let me think," said Mrs. O'Keefe.
She put a hand to her cheek tremblingly.
"I believe I did," said Mrs. O'Keefe.
"Was he carrying anything?" Ada asked.
"Now I can't recall," said Mrs. O'Keefe.
"Which way did he walk?"
"That way," she said,
pointing down Shawmut Way toward Savinhill Avenue, the way one walked to cross over the bridge into the rest of Dorchester. "What was he wearing?" Ada asked her. "Did he say hello to you?" But again, she couldn't recall. Liston's car was a station wagon with wooden sides and a bench seat across the front. She was leaning against it when Ada arrived, and she held the passenger door open.
"Hi, baby," said Liston.
She looked worried. She was wearing sunglasses on her head and an oversized windbreaker. They pulled out, and Liston turned left on Savinhill Avenue. She asked where Ada thought they should look for him, and she suggested they go over the bridge, first to David's favorite restaurant, Trans, and then to the library in Fields Corner, and then along Morrissey Boulevard, passing the beaches on the way to Castle Island, toward which David often jogged, and finally to the lab.
"Any place else?" asked Liston.
"I don't know," said Ada.
"He didn't give you any hints. He hasn't been talking about going any place in particular?"
"No," said Ada, wishing she could answer differently.
"And has he disappeared like this before?"
Ada hesitated. She did not want to tell Liston the truth, which was, of course, that he had. A few hours here, there. She settled on an answer that sounded all right in her head.
"Just a couple of times," she said.
"Never for long." Liston shook her head.
"Oh, David," she said.
And in her voice, Ada heard some piece of knowledge that she was not sharing. It was true that Liston and David were close,
and had been since he had hired her almost 15 years before. But there was no one, Ada felt, who understood him as Ada herself did. She didn't like to hear Liston speak of him dismissively. She didn't want her to feel that they were conspiring or that they shared any common criticisms of David. Ada thought back to the telephone conversation she had overheard Liston having with David and wondered if there was any possible way to explain how she had come to overhear it. She decided at last that there was not. She wanted badly to know what Liston had been speaking of. Not knowing made her feel less close to David. She had always imagined herself as his confidant, his right hand, and didn't like to think of anyone knowing something about him that she herself wasn't privy to. "How long has he been gone now?" Liston asked, and Ada checked her watch. It was just after 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
8 hours, she said. "At least. I woke up at 7 o'clock and he was already gone."
"We'll give it a while longer," said Liston. "I called my friend Bobby in the police department. He told me they wouldn't start searching until tomorrow anyway, even if we called in."
And she must have seen the nervous look on Ada's face, for she assured her that he would most likely be back before then.
"I bet you he'll be back by dinner time," said Liston.
But she, too, looked worried.
"He had not been into trans," said Tran.
"Is he okay?"
he asked, and the two lines between his eyebrows deepened. He loved David. Ada assured him that David was fine, digging down deep into her reserves of strength to do so, and then returned to Liston's car. They continued along for a time. Ada slumped against the seat, her head against the headrest, scanning the sidewalks on either side of the road for David. She searched the roadsides for his shining head, for a tall man in a t-shirt and shorts, or in trousers and a threadbare Oxford, jangling his limbs about in a way that seemed incompatible with speed, and yet propelled him forcefully ahead. Liston tried to make small talk with her, telling her one or another little anecdote about the grad students or about Martha, the division secretary. "All she wants, poor thing, is a date with a normal man." But Ada could only muster the briefest of replies. David was nowhere they looked. Their drive became a silent one, strange and uncomfortable. For the first time, Ada allowed herself to truly wonder if her father was gone completely, disappeared altogether. Kidnapped, dead on some lonesome road in the mountains of New Hampshire or New York, or injured badly, unable to call for help, or, worst of all, gone of his own volition. Was it possible, she wondered, that he had abandoned her? It was such a contrast to anything she understood about her father that she could not process the idea. At last they pulled back onto Shawmut Way, and Liston stopped in David's driveway, where his car was still parked. For several seconds, neither of them moved. It was quiet. Ada could hear children playing a block away. Small clicks and pings emanated from beneath the hood of Liston's station wagon as the engine settled and cooled. The house looked too still.
"I'll come in with you," said Liston.
And together they exited the car and approached the house. Would her father be inside? Would he be frantic, apologetic? Would he have an explanation for them both? Inside, it was quiet.
"David?"
called Ada. Once. Twice. But there was no response. Liston turned to her. On her face, Ada saw an expression that was meant to register as cheerfulness, but came off as doubt. Liston checked her watch, and Ada did the same. 5 o'clock in the evening.
"Tell you what," said Liston brightly, "why don't you come over for a while? Pack some overnight things, just in case. I'll go get a room ready back at the house."
Ada's heart increased its pace. The idea of spending time at Liston's while her sons were there was simultaneously appealing and terrifying.
"Come on," said Liston. "We'll get you a snack, too."
It was only then that Ada realized she had not eaten all day. Upstairs, alone, Ada packed a nightgown, her hairbrush, some clothes for the next day. To pack more than these seemed pessimistic. And 7 books, all into the little blue suitcase that was hers to use. David had a matching one in green. Then she went downstairs and wrote a new note for David. "David," it said, "I am really scared. Where are you? I'm at Liston's. Please call right away." And then, just in case, she wrote down Liston's number too, which David knew like his own pulse. She exited the kitchen, leaving the door unlocked for her father. She walked toward Liston's. Liston's house had a front porch, and on it were 2 boys' bicycles leaned in toward one another, and a girl's pink bicycle with its tassels chopped off 1 inch from each handle. Someone had begun to color the pink seat black with a permanent marker, but had only gotten halfway. Like all the houses on the block, Liston's was a colorful Victorian, painted a different color every 10 years or so. That decade, it was light blue with dark blue shutters and edges. The porch itself had been painted the color of the trim, so that walking on it gave one the feeling of being underwater. It was nearly time for a new paint job. The existing color had begun to come up off the wooden floor and down from the ceiling, and small, unsettled piles of paint chips had made their way into crevices and corners. Once or twice, Ada had seen Liston briskly sweeping the porch in the front walkway, but mainly she had no time for such details, preferring instead to maintain, she told Ada, the highest level of cleanliness her busy schedule would allow. She would not have dreamed of bringing in a cleaning service. To her, they were for rich people. Ada walked up the steps with great apprehension and raised her fist to knock softly on the door. No one answered. She looked at her watch and told herself that if, after 2 minutes, no one had answered, she would try again. She did, with slightly greater force, and this time quick footsteps came rushing toward the door, and Maddie opened it. He said nothing. He was 9 years old at the time, tall for his age. He had a feathery haircut, and he wore denim cutoffs and a red striped tank top. Both knees were scraped up, and as he appraised Ada, he reached down to scratch at one of his scabs absentmindedly. "Hi," Ada said.
"Hi."
"I'm here to see your mom," she told him. She felt ridiculous saying it, only 4 years older than he was, and yet playing the role of an adult, a friend of his mother's. But at that moment, Liston came into sight behind Maddie, sock-footed.
"What are you doing, Maddie? Open the door for Ada," she said, and then did it herself. And Maddie shrugged and ran upstairs.
"No manners," said Liston, after Ada had stepped inside. Liston shut the inner door behind them. Liston hated the heat more than anyone Ada had ever met, and several years before had installed central air in her 100-year-old house, which cost her more than she cared to admit. All spring, Ada had seen men working on Liston's roof, coming and going through the front door. Now a large metal box occupied a space in her backyard, near the patio, and inside the house it felt calm and cool and shadowy. The sweat on Ada's neck cooled and disappeared. She had only been in Liston's house a handful of times before. Normally, when she and David got together outside work, it was at a restaurant or at David's house. In its layout, her home was similar to David's. Living room, sitting room, dining room, kitchen on the first floor, bedrooms above. But she had decorated it quite differently. All the upholstery was floral or patterned in some way, in accordance with the fashion of the decade. Large framed mirrors hung on some of the walls, so that Ada could not avoid seeing herself at every turn. Prints of famous paintings or reproductions of movie posters hung on others. Liston brought her into the kitchen, which was larger than David's, and sat Ada down at a built-in nook that looked something like a booth at a restaurant.
"What can I get you to eat, hun?"
asked Liston, and rattled off a list of all the snacks of the 1980s that Ada was never permitted to have. Canned pastas by Chef Boyardee, fluffer nutter sandwiches, fluorescent Kraft macaroni and cheese. In truth, Ada had never even heard of some of the food Liston offered her. She chose the sandwich, thinking it would mean the least work, and Liston scooped out something white and soft and put it on a piece of Wonder Bread with peanut butter on another piece, and then she closed them together with a clap and handed it to Ada with a glass of milk. For a while, she watched Ada eat. Then finally, she spoke. "What do you want to do? Do you want to watch TV?" Ada opened and closed her mouth twice. "Do you not watch TV?" Liston inquired.
"No, I do,"
said Ada, and told herself that it was not, in fact, a lie, because there was a police drama that David and she watched together sometimes, and occasionally David rented and watched old films or television shows on the VCR, which counted, she supposed. Ada followed Liston into what she called the TV room, which David would have called a sitting room. And there it was, a big box of a television, as big as any Ada had ever seen. Facing it was a couch with a right angle built into it. She sat down there in the elbow of the curve. She put a pillow over her lap. Liston turned on the television with a remote control, which she handed to Ada.
"We just got cable," said Liston. "There are probably 100 channels on there. I don't know what half of them are."
Ada inspected the remote. David had made a primitive variant that they used at home, but this one looked official and had many more buttons.
"I'll be working in the kitchen if you need me," said Liston.
Ada flipped upward through the channels. The following images came onto the screen,